Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast, where we aim to be as good at the human side of healthcare as we are at the clinical side of healthcare. My name is Chris Desmond. I'm a physiotherapist who's fascinated by how we can better help the person with the problem. Join us as we learn how to connect better, how to show up better, and how to understand our patients and ourselves better. Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast, where we get to explore the human side of healthcare with experts so we can better help the person with the problem. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Danielle Blanche-Hartigan. Danielle has PhD and MPH. She is a social scientist with interdisciplinary research and teaching interests in psychology and public health. And her research, broadly defined, aims to understand how psychological constructs influence the powerful relationships between healthcare providers and patients to foster patient-centered care and improve patient perceptions of their care. I'm excited. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this conversation since we first connected a month or so ago.
Yeah.
Really kind of excited to see what comes from it. The first question I always love to start with is, why are you interested in the art of healthcare? What interests you about the human side of health?
The short answer is everything. But, you know, I think, so you said my background, I'm not a clinician, which may be different from some of your listeners or some of the other experts that you've had on, and certainly yourself in clinical practice. I'm a social psychologist by training, which means I've always been fascinated by human behavior and why we do the things we do and why we make the perceptions that we do of other people. But in my social psychology training, as I was learning about, you know, the theories behind person perception and emotion recognition, I always was drawn to how we applied that in healthcare settings. I just think it's one of the most, and I think you and your listeners would agree, kind of one of the most high stakes contexts for interacting interpersonally, making sure that, you know, we are really addressing the needs of patients. And so kind of my goal with, you know, kind of everything I do is how to improve the patient experience through better communication. And so I just think it's so important to think kind of beyond, you know, what we might think of as the clinical skills that we're most trained on and focus more on that kind of art of communication.
I completely agree with that, but I'm biased. And hopefully the people listening to this are somewhat agree, at least. Danielle, I probably want to kick the conversation off with an important topic in the healthcare space, and one that is maybe slightly poorly defined and a little bit scary for some healthcare providers. And that's the concept of empathy and bringing empathy into our practice. And I know you've done a lot of thinking and research in this area. And I'm interested in what is empathy in clinical interactions, and how does it show up differently for the different participants?
Yeah. So, I mean, just the concept of empathy, like you said, is so broad, so scary, so fraught with not necessarily misunderstanding, but a heterogeneity of understanding. It encompasses so many specific concepts and behaviors. And what lots of researchers, including myself, have talked about, especially recently, is the fact that, you know, everybody is defining empathy in a different way. So one of the most frustrating things is when I hear or come across clinical education tools or training programs, or, you know, I work in a business school, so there's a lot of corporate consulting type programs that do the same thing. And they say things like, you know, empathy is key. Empathy is so important. So we need to focus on being more empathic, right? We need to be more empathic with our patients, or, you know, be more empathic with our customers. That's going to be the key to, you know, better relationships. And my frustration with that is, well, what does that actually mean? And does it mean the same thing to everybody? And what we've shown recently in a few studies that are, you know, kind of either hot off the presses or on their way, is that even amongst clinicians and patients, everybody is thinking of empathy different. And so some people, you know, kind of hardcore psychologists, when they think about empathy, it's really the ability to feel the feelings of another person, right? But when you talk to clinicians about what they think empathy is, you know, it can be spending enough time with patients. When you talk to patients about what empathy is, they might even bring in the fact that they didn't have to wait a long time in the waiting room as a sign that their physician was being empathic with them. And so, you know, really, I don't mind the term empathy. I think it's an important term. I think we need to continue talking about, you know, being more empathic as part of the art of healthcare. But we've got to get better at what that means. And the only way to train it and improve the skill is to really focus, in my mind, on what specific behaviors convey empathy and are perceived as empathic by our patients.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And listening to you talk there as well is that, I mean, there's that difference between effective empathy and cognitive empathy as well, and kind of how we bring that into our practice. And I mean, most people just say empathy, as you say, and we need to do, how do we do it? How do we get better at it? And that's, I think, one of the frustrating things for us as clinicians is that you read the study that comes out saying you need to be more empathic, but there's no process to it. There's no way that is suggested that we can train that for ourselves, which is challenging, especially when we learn all the biomedical stuff. There's a diagnosis and then there's a prescription afterwards. This is what we can do. And I mean, for a concept like empathy, there's the empathy diagnosis. Is there a prescription or some behaviors that we can look to start to practice that will improve our empathy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I want to step back one thing to what you said, which is kind of, and you know, I think we kind of talked about even right at the beginning, you introduced, you know, kind of comparing empathy and the art of healthcare to kind of the biomedical clinical skill. And one of my biggest pet peeves, if you can't tell by, you know, my face and voice right now, is thinking of empathy as a soft skill, or, you know, frankly, even thinking of it as an art versus a science, because we have a huge science of nonverbal behavior, a huge science around how people perceive and respond to empathy, a huge science about the effectiveness of empathy. You know, one of my colleagues did an amazing study showing that clinicians showing a little bit more empathy, you know, as it was defined in the study, kind of patient-centered, affiliative, verbal and nonverbal behavior to a patient in pain actually reduced their pain experience, right? So, you know, if I told you that was a drug, you'd say, okay, I get it. Or if I told you that was a, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, you'd say, okay, you know, that's a clinical skill. But this was just the element of the communication. And so I actually found something yesterday I wanted to read as a student sent this to me, was we were talking about empathy and they said, you know, we're hearing a lot calling it soft skills. And it was from this website and they said, workers acquire hard skills through formal education, training programs, and concentrated effort. Hard skills are the quantifiable skills workers need to have in order to successfully perform a specific job. Employers often test or evaluate a candidate's hard skills before hiring. You know, and they say examples of hard skills include computer programming, writing, web development, and graphic design. Now, you know, examples of hard skills in clinical settings, you know, we know, like you said, diagnosis, picking the appropriate treatment, right, performing the surgery. And then it says hard skills can be learned and perfected over time, but soft skills are more difficult to acquire and change. The soft skills acquired for a doctor, for example, would be empathy, understanding, active listening, and good bedside manner, right? It's just so frustrating to me because there's two big myths. There's the myth that empathy can't be trained, and there's the myth that empathy isn't a skill in the same way that performing a surgery is a skill, and that there's this kind of underlying assumption that empathy and that these, you know, nonverbal and communication type behaviors don't have kind of a tangible science behind them. So I just kind of want to put that out there because I think one of the things in my work has shown that we actually can train for good communication and empathy and person perception and understanding other people. And we can and that these are skills, right? That they're individual differences and that they're hard work, right? They're cognitively taxing in the same way that, you know, performing a surgery or, you know, a medical procedure would be. So I don't know that that answered your question, but I kind of want to get that out of the way because I feel like there's that myth or that perception and it's kind of problematic.
Yeah, I think that's really, really valuable as well to hear you say that. And it is, it's frustrating. I mean, these are potentially more challenging skills to learn and acquire than kind of following a pathological process because of the human element. And there's a little bit of messiness with that. But as you say, there's a lot of science behind that. And like your study around the communication with people and being able to reduce their pain, their perception of pain through that interaction is really, really fascinating. And there is, I mean, there's a lot of it, or there's a growing body of evidence out there as well that shows the way that we communicate and with in regards to empathy in particular has responses at that physiological level in our bodies as well. It's like there is that kind of cellular process that's going on when we communicate with people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how do we do it? What behaviors should we try and bring into our practice?
Great question. So I've, you know, done some work on kind of nonverbal behaviors. And like you said, it is tricky, right? And no two patients are going to respond the same way to particular nonverbal behaviors, but there are some basic ones, and there's some ones that you know have a good amount of evidence behind them. So one thing we know is that first impressions are really important for establishing rapport in an interaction and for, you know, kind of overall perceptions of patients of their clinicians. And so in that first minute, that first few minutes of the interaction, there are some kind of simple verbal and nonverbal things. And I would point you, there's some great frameworks for this, including the Four Habits framework is a good one, and the Calgary framework, you know, that really say in that first few minutes, it's about kind of establishing a connection. And you can do that, you know, with really simple things like greeting the patient by name, asking their name, giving your name and who you are and why you're there and what your title is, right? And that might seem silly, but there's plenty of times where, you know, especially in, for example, hospital settings where people will walk in the room and the patient has no idea, is this, you know, somebody there to change the bed sheets to, you know, this is, or to all the way up to, is this my surge? And kind of what the goals for that meeting are. So those are kind of some of the verbal things. Nonverbally, it's about in that first few minutes, you know, kind of looking the patient in the eye, not getting distracted by medical records, you know, kind of taking that moment to establish the connection. You know, posture is really important. So kind of how you're positioned, orienting yourself towards the patient, forward lean, nodding, smiling. I mean, these are a whole host of nonverbal behaviors that together form kind of an affiliative impression for the patient.
Really, really helpful to hear that. And listening to you, I was kind of thinking, hopefully I do that most of the time. But I guess it's also one thing to hear that and kind of hear the list of those things and to try and implement them into your practice. But also we can't be thinking about all of the different ones too much in that those first couple of minutes of interaction, because otherwise we're distracted with that, like we would be distracted with the medical notes, and we're not present for that important connection piece with the person.
Yeah, and you know, I think certainly time is a factor, but one of the really interesting things, you know, people say, well, patient, you know, establishing these patient-centered connections and, you know, demonstrating empathy necessitates longer visits, right? If you're going to address the patient emotions and, you know, make sure that there's a good exchange of information and you manage the patient's uncertainty and all these aspects of patient-centered care, you know, we actually see they don't take longer, right? So it's not about the length. It's not about spending 5 minutes chatting with your patient about, you know, their recent vacation if you don't have the time for that. But it is about, you know, really in those first 20 seconds when you say, what brings you in today? Or how have you been since your last visit? Or how are things going for you? You know, whatever it is that you like to say to kind of start the visit, really listening, not interrupting. You know, there's so much literature about the doctors interrupting the patient in the first, you know, 17 seconds, 20 seconds, right? But the fact that there's interruption at all in that first formative minutes of the interaction are really powerful. Just giving the patient a chance to kind of get out their goals for the visit. And, you know, again, that involves the verbal of asking, you know, what are your goals for today and here for this visit? But in some ways, it's more the nonverbal cues you're giving of, you know, as the patient starts talking, are you looking at them or are you kind of orienting towards the computer for the tasks that you have to do? Are you interrupting them or are you kind of pausing it, giving that space?
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I'm also interested in how we perceive not verbal and nonverbal information in an interaction and how we use it to make judgments about each other. So how we use it to make, maybe how we use it to make judgments of the patients, but also how patients use it to make judgments of us as well. And I know that you've done a lot of thinking and research in this area. So maybe if we start with how is verbal and nonverbal information perceived, and then how do we use that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so this is the science of person perception. So in the world of social psychology, we've been studying this, you know, for decades, kind of trying to understand how people use information in an interpersonal context to form judgments about other people, right? When you look at a picture of a dorm room, can you tell if that person is conscientious or optimistic or, right? Can we make personality judgment cues about somebody? And we constantly do this. We make judgments about people and their, you know, states and traits based on the physical bone structure of their faces. We do this and frankly, we can be pretty accurate at it. So there's this concept in person perception on kind of the accuracy, and some people, and it's an individual difference, meaning some people are really good at it, right? You probably know those people. You walk in the room and they say, hey, Chris, you okay? You look something, are you, you know, something was a little off today. And then you probably know those people that you could be having the worst day ever, practically crying in front of them and they're clueless. So this is true for doctors too, and clinicians, right? Of all kinds, that, you know, some people are kind of just naturally better at recognizing and responding to verbal and nonverbal cues. And we know in clinical settings, for example, that patients put out a lot of cues to their emotions, especially nonverbally. You know, the patient's shaking their leg and tapping their foot because they're nervous. They're, you know, sighing, they're looking away. There are lots of these kind of little moments in a clinical interaction that are opportunities or cues to explore what the patient is thinking or feeling a little bit more deeply. Again, we know from research, what happens in the context of a clinical interaction is there's so much to get done that we often miss or don't respond to these cues. And so, but what's hard is there's no dictionary, right? There's no dictionary to say, okay, Chris, if you see a patient that, you know, has this particular facial muscle movement, it must mean they are sad, right? Or if you see a patient fidgeting, it must mean that they are anxious about their upcoming procedure. There's no dictionary, just like in, you know, medical diagnosis, right? If you see a patient with, you know, a particular range of motion issue, right? It doesn't always mean the same thing clinically. That's where the art comes in diagnosis, right? In your field, you have to figure it out. So the same thing is true with emotions. We can get better at accurately perceiving patients by learning to recognize and respond to those little nonverbal moments or cues and really being present enough to notice them. Right? So you're not going to notice if a patient is fidgeting or sighing if you're wrapped up, you know, typing things in the computer or thinking about the next question you're going to ask or going through the rest of the things you have to do that day.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm probably privileged in this area is that I get paid to watch how people move. So I kind of, it's been trained and ingrained into me. So often what I'll see in the clinic room is when I'm sitting having a conversation with someone and I ask them something that trigger response is that their hands will tighten on the armrest of the chair, or their fist will curl up, or their shoulders will come up and get a little bit closer to their ears. So they're adopting a lot of those defensive postures. And I'll see that, and I won't always kind of follow up with that, but probably now more often than not I would. And I'll just say to them, I was like, hey, you're having a protection reaction when we brought that up. Like, is there more to that for you, or is what else might be going on there? And just kind of allow them a gentle way in to go and explore that topic. And a surprising amount of time, people don't realize that they've had that reaction, that that's something that's happened involuntarily for them. But kind of when you start to unpack it, sometimes it allows you to see barriers to progress for this person that wouldn't have come up in conversation because there wasn't that awareness around them to start with.
And I think what's important, especially if you're not very comfortable or not very good at this, or you're not always sure what the patient might be thinking and feeling in that moment, is that actually some of the research I've done and then others have done shows, it doesn't matter necessarily. So kind of missing the cue or not responding to the cue is a lot worse than kind of getting it wrong. So patients are pretty forgiving if you say, you know, hey, you're looking pretty frustrated with what I just said. You know, were you expecting something different? And the patient says, no, I'm not frustrated. I'm just nervous. Like, this is a big thing that's coming up. The patient is not angry that you thought it was frustration and it was really anxiety. The patient is happy, you know, perceives that you have noticed that they're feeling something, and then it allows for that kind of joint understanding. So I think sometimes what happens is, you know, you see the hands clenching or you hear the sigh and, you know, you're not quite sure what it means. And so you say, okay, let me just not go there, right? Whereas what you said, it really allows you to kind of go there. Like, I noticed your hands are clenched. You know, is everything all right? Are you nervous about this, right? And letting them kind of tell you. And actually, that's the way you learn. So sometimes I talk about the training. I can talk a little bit about kind of training this skill.
Yeah, that would be awesome. But I want to just recognize the language that you use there as well, because I think that's really important when you're going and asking people who are already in this defensive mindset or this protection response that they've got going on, is that we use non-threatening language. You don't want to throw out, hey, you look scared, or you look stressed, or You seem
angry. Are you mad at me?
Yeah, which is often language that's kind of what pops into our head, that this person is scared or stressed or angry. But it triggers again a defensive response in people. So that your use of, hey, you seem a little bit frustrated here, or you seem a little bit worried, or
all of a sudden I noticed that I said that and you seem to tense up a little bit.
Yeah,
right, like calling out the. And, you know, why is there, and they, like you said, maybe they didn't even realize they responded. Lots of, you know, there's a whole literature in sort of psychology about how we, you know, sometimes we are not, oftentimes we're not meta-aware or consciously aware of our own nonverbal, often not aware of how our own nonverbals are perceived by others. So a patient might, you know, kind of be relieved that you're noticing these little cues.
Mm, yeah. Cool. Let's loop back around. How do we get better at it?
Hey there team, we're just taking a short break in the chat to let you know about something really exciting. Podcasts are great, and I'm sure that you're getting a whole heap from this one, but they don't always move the needle on improving our skill set in the human side of healthcare. And that's why I've set up the Art of Healthcare team. It's a safe and supportive online community of healthcare providers learning from experts and each other about how to really up our game in the human skill sets that are vital for delivering healthcare in the future. So when you're ready, we'd love for you to join us. Head on over to team.artofhealthcare.nz to find out more and to sign up. Back to the show.
So first of all, there's a big myth in empathy and nonverbal behavior, person perception, and all these areas in that little quote I read you from that random, you know, website, that these skills cannot be trained, right? That they're kind of part of interpersonal interactions that we develop over time, or that some people are just good at naturally versus not, or, you know, certain groups like women are better at this than men. And again, that's really frustrating because we know that these skills can be trained, and that training, there are really effective trainings to improve your ability to recognize and respond to the emotions of another person, for example. And we've seen this with doctors, we've seen it in lots of other contexts. The key, though, appears to be, as I said, there's no encyclopedia for this. There's no dictionary for nonverbal behavior. And so the key seems to really be the ability to practice these skills. But even more important than practice is to receive feedback. You may be like, well, that just happens naturally, clinically, but it really doesn't. So, you know, you don't hear from patients things like, you know, hey, Chris, you know, I just raised my shoulders and tensed up there because I was nervous about what you said and getting a little bit defensive, but you didn't notice, right? So, because either the patient themselves isn't aware of it, or they're just, we don't have that mechanism, right? You don't, you know, maybe you're talking with your spouse, you know, maybe they'll tell you, I was really pissed off at you earlier today and you didn't even notice, right? But they probably aren't going to tell you, here's exactly non-verbally how I showed you I was pissed off at you. And so the good trainings allow for people to receive feedback about how they recognized and responded to the cues of whether they were accurate or not. So we can do this, you know, kind of with formal training program, but also, you know, again, soliciting feedback about like, hey, you know, I noticed that you tensed up a little bit. You want to tell me like how you're feeling about what I just said? And you're going to actually get the feedback of, I tensed up because I was frustrated. And next time you see that patient tense up, you're going to realize this patient's frustrated. Or, you know, you might hear a whole set of emotions or reactions that cause your patients to tense up. And then you'll know kind of in the future what to look for and what that might be. You see, it's kind of this practice with specific, ideally real-time feedback about how, what the nonverbal behaviors and cues mean and how you can best respond to them.
Yeah, and I think what might be helpful then for people is to, like, if we're looking to elicit this real-time feedback, is to maybe come up with a list of a few questions that you could ask people in that moment and have them prepared already so that you've got a go-to when you see something happen, you're like, actually, I've practiced these three questions. I'm going to use one of them now so that I can try and pull out some more information.
And, you know, I think your point before about, you know, you don't necessarily need to say, hey, you seem mad, right? Why are you mad? You can actually say something like, just take a moment to pause when you see a cue or something you think might be a cue, or, right, you can stop and say, so how are you feeling about what I just said? And that allow the patient to kind of share with you what those nonverbal cues that they may or may not even be aware of just meant. Or, you know, again, you can kind of talk about it directly. Like, it seemed like you just tensed up right there. You know, is there anything I've said that you want mommy to give you more detail about or that made you nervous or something like that?
Yeah, they're great ones as well. One thing that I also use is people's tone of voice as well. You can, like, if you pick up something strange in their tone of voice, I'll often respond just with, hey, you don't seem quite sure about that answer that you just gave then. Like, is there more to it than that? Or is there something else that's happening there? And like, as New Zealanders, we tend to go up in terms of tonality towards the end of a sentence anyway. So people always think that we're asking questions when we're just making a statement, and that's just how we talk. So you need to be mindful of that as well. But kind of listening out for changes in tone of voice as well, I think is something that I find it often gives you a little bit more insight.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's kind of a whole host of nonverbal cues. And, you know, we then tend to think about things like facial expression, gestures, body posture, body movement, and then the kind of paraverbal cues like you're talking about, which can be things like tone of voice, volume. It can be even things like absence of cues, right? So pausing, hesitating. And one of the interesting things about telemedicine may be that we actually have a chance to kind of see what's behind the patient in their home environment. And, you know, maybe you notice something that seems different for that patient, or, you know, you might not want to call it out directly, like your house seems a lot more disheveled than it did last time we talked. I'm blurry for that reason behind me, right? But maybe, you know, you notice things like that patient always comes in looking really put together and polished and, you know, or in a certain type of dress. And then you notice the next time that they're not quite looking like themselves. You know, these are kind of things that we pick up on, but it does take mental effort to do all this. And, you know, I think that's really key. Like you would say, okay, if you have to go through a patient's medical chart, medical record, you know, all the lab results, you know, nobody would argue that it takes mental effort to kind of put those pieces together, look for little cues in their, you know, in their blood work that might signal a problem, try to piece together those things. We're doing the same thing interpersonally and nonverbally when we're using credit for the fact that that's a skill and that's work. And, you know, that takes kind of conscious effort to do. And you know, if there's a checklist of clinical things you need to think about, there's also kind of a checklist of some of these nonverbal things you need to be aware of or think about or question.
Yeah. And I think we forget that this is a new skill often for us, or something that we haven't trained before, that we've just kind of relied on natural ability. So when we start to train it, it's challenging. Do you have a handy checklist of things that we should be looking out for to just be really reductionist and bring it back to that?
You know, again, there's kind of no dictionary of nonverbal behavior, but I do think it's looking for these moments, these emotion cues in a clinical interaction. And by emotions, I'm kind of talking about that really broadly. It could be, you know, anxiety cues. It could be uncertainty cues. You know, the kind of the state of your patient, right, emotionally and psychologically. You know, there are a list of kind of nonverbal behaviors that you can look to shed some light. Now, that's going to be different for every patient, and the same nonverbal behavior might mean two different things based on the patient's own individual differences in that, based on how emotive the patient is themselves, based on their culture or their cultural norms around, you know, what they bring into the visit, you know, but you've at least kind of thought about, what is my patient's, you know, facial muscle movements telling me? What is my patient's posture telling me? What is my patient's gestures telling me? What is their tone of voice indicating to me in this moment? You know, kind of going through a checklist of all the nonverbal behaviors and what they might mean. And we, that sounds hard and that's a lot, but, you know, it gets easier over time as we kind of practice and get better at kind of eliciting these cues as well.
Just like any other skill. Danielle, I mean, healthcare is changing at the moment. You know, over the last, 18 months, 2 years, we've seen...
How long have we been doing this?
we've seen telemedicine really, really increase in terms of it's how we utilize it. What are some of the communication challenges and opportunities that come with telemedicine, and do we need to be doing things differently?
So I think, you know, for me, as somebody that studies interpersonal interactions in healthcare and somebody that's interested in nonverbal behaviors, you know, I've been thinking about kind of telemedicine and digital health, but they were kind of on the outskirts, right? And that they were used relatively infrequently in specific contexts with specific patient populations. And what we saw literally overnight with COVID is, you know, that the scale up of the capability. So the capability was there. You know, there's been lots of science about how people interact over these platforms, you know, for years and years, but now it's everybody, right? And I don't see it going anywhere, right? That we are going to have an increased presence of telemedicine into the future. And, you know, it's so beneficial for patients and providers in so many ways. But I do think the same kind of science that we've applied to interpersonal communication in person, we need to apply a systematic science to study the verbal and nonverbal behaviors in telemedicine, perceptions in telemedicine, and the norms are different and the rules are different. And we are all quickly learning the norm. So something like gaze patterns, you know, lots of really interesting work about patients and providers looking each other in the eye and how important that is in clinical interactions. And what's, you know, too much gaze and not enough, right? I mean, we have kind of a good science around that. The rules are different. Like, I'm looking at you right now, but it probably doesn't look like it because of where my camera's facing and how. And if we had, you know, three boxes here, I mean, we all know we've been zooming now for 18 months. And so I think being really systematic about how these cues are being perceived, what is going to be affected in this space, you know, and we also, and then realizing as a provider, you have access to less information, right? So you might not see the patient's foot shaking or what they're doing. I mean, I'm talking with my hands a lot, which the listeners can't see, you know, what does that not having that information mean? But, you know, maybe it makes other cues more salient. So I have a colleague who studies this kind of work with me. And, you know, he's talking about that the sound quality in an online interaction is different than in real interpersonal interaction, and the amount of information we might have about voice tone might be different. And also, I mentioned earlier, we're really interested in what does the digital environment do to the perceptions of patients and the, you know, outcomes of the clinical interactions. We have a study where we experimentally manipulated backgrounds, and we looked at how patients recalled information presented during, you know, a mock telehealth visit. And what's so interesting is the more the patient liked the background, the less information they recalled from the interaction. And yeah, you know, we need, it's one small study, we need a lot more information about why and how, but, you know, maybe there's something about, you know, the fact that you have pictures and a keyboard behind you that changes how I perceive you, how we talk today in really subtle ways. And so, again, I'm not sure that the evidence is out yet about, you know, what's the best background to have or what cues to look for or how to judge if a patient, you know, kind of looks away in a telemedicine interaction. What does that mean?
Actually, 1-year-old says just crawl into the room.
But again, it's about kind of being conscious that these are cues, potential cues that to something that's going on, right? And we may need to do things a little bit differently, but I think that the underlying principles of establishing rapport and building a trusting relationship and making sure that, you know, you're recognizing the emotions and responding to the emotions and uncertainty in an interaction. But how that might change a little bit, but the need for that is going. In fact, it might even be stronger when we're not face to face.
Yeah. Thank you. That's really interesting. And like, it'll be fascinating to read the research around this as it starts to come out over the next year or two as well, and kind of what we should be looking for and what we shouldn't. Because I think there are a lot of pros to telemedicine in a lot of spaces. And I mean, we've been lucky and privileged here in New Zealand as well, is that like we have been able to do a lot of face-to-face healthcare for a long part of this. There's been pockets where we haven't, and where we've obviously had restrictions on us, but we've been able to be in clinic rooms and be interacting with people in a relatively normal mask wearing way.
Yeah, but I don't think that like the art of healing goes away just because you're in this space, right? And I mean, we'll need more research, but the early indications are that you can still build, you know, a meaningful healing relationship. You can still establish trust and rapport. You can still provide good quality care for, you know, a whole host of things. And so I'm much more optimistic about the potential for telemedicine than I was, you know, 2 years ago, because I think once we've seen everybody, you know, so talk about a learning curve, right? Once everybody had to learn what this new medium was and how to interact over it, you know, we learned pretty quick kind of what the norms are around interacting. So I think we can make it work.
Yeah, I completely agree. Danielle, based off our conversation today, depending on when people are listening to it, what's one thing that they should go and put into practice this afternoon or tomorrow morning?
Oh, geez. One thing. You know, I think it's.
You can have two if you want.
Oh, no. I'll get one. It's appreciating the effort that this takes and not diminishing, recognizing and responding to the emotions and nonverbal behaviors and, you know, kind of interpersonal cues of your patients, you know, realizing that's hard work, giving yourself credit and maybe even demanding credit from others that, you know, when you're really good at it, that it is a skill. It's a skill you can build and just being, realizing that it's going to take a conscious effort to build that skill. And I love your idea of, you know, kind of giving yourself one or two or three things you can say when you start to notice these things, but maybe try in each visit, in each clinical interaction, to notice one nonverbal interpersonal emotion cue. And it doesn't have to be a negative thing, right? Not every patient's frustrated, nervous, uncertain, right? Notice when your patient is appreciative. Notice when your patient is relieved or happy or thankful or proud. And I think over time, you'll start to build that reflex, that muscle to recognize and respond to these things. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Danielle, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been awesome to have a chat with you.
Yes, it was wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
And if people are interested in your work and finding out more about it, is there somewhere that they can go and check that out?
So there is a great new book, of which I wrote a chapter on training, but the book itself is fabulous, about emotions in the clinical encounter by Judy Hall and Rachel Schwartz. That is kind of hot off the presses, or, you know, Google Scholar is always a great place to start. I would recommend the work of Rick Street and Ron Epstein, patient-centered communication, patient-centered care. Judy Hall was my mentor, and her and Deborah Roeder have written a fabulous book about patients talking to doctors, doctors talking to patients, and interpersonal interactions. I recommend those as really kind of accessible places to start.
Thank you so much for that.
And also, people can reach out to me directly. I'm happy to. I'm dhartigan@bentley.edu. And any questions or people that are interested in this, I'm happy to pass along resources. It's my favorite thing to talk about, obviously. So,
That's great.
That's a wrap, team. I really hope you enjoyed that one. If you want to support the show, the best way you can do that is to share this episode out with your friends, your colleagues, your mum, someone who you think might enjoy it, and to make sure that you hit subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. For more resources for all the episodes, for more information about the Art of Healthcare team, head on over to artofhealthcare.nz and you can find all of that stuff there. The amazing theme music for the episode was produced by my brother Jeremy Desmond, but otherwise you can blame me and my wonderful guest for the rest of the stuff. Thank you guys again so much for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for showing the love. I really appreciate you. Have a great week.